Welcome to Stutter Talk, episode 318, The Stuttering Analogy Show, for January 29th, 2012. But first, Stutter Talk wants to remind you about an upcoming one-day stuttering workshop happening in North Carolina. Friends, the National Association for Young People Who Stutter, the Stuttering Foundation of America, and the Wake County Public School Speech and Language Department present Children, Teens, and Adults Who Stutter, Families, Professionals, and Friends Working Together. Saturday, March 3rd, 2012, 9:30 in the morning till 4 p.m. Eastern in Cary, North Carolina. The keynote presenter is Dr. David Shapiro. Other presenters include Lee Caggiano, Steffi Shopik, Rita Thurman, and Taro Alexander. For more information on this event and to view the brochure, go to stuttertalk.com and follow the Friends Conference link in the left-hand sidebar at the top of the site. Enjoy the show.
I accept this on behalf of all the stutterers throughout the world. We have a voice. We have been heard.
Hey everyone, well, welcome to Stutter Talk, changing how you think about stuttering one podcast at a time. This is the Stuttering Analogies Spectacular Show with Dr. Robert Quiesel. How are you, Bob?
Okay, Peter.
Awesome.
How are you?
I am good, using some good voluntary stuttering, and hoping this show does not turn into 3 hours, because it easily could. Easily.
Yes.
The listeners know Bob well. They know him as Robert the Expert Quiesel. Bob's a professor of communication sciences and disorders at Western Illinois University, a person who stutters, a fellow of the American Speech Language Hearing Association, a board-recognized fluency specialist, and a Stutter Talk advisor. All right, Bob. Let's just get the biggest stuttering analogy out of the way. Probably the one that's most used and most known. How about that? Do you want to take a stab at it? Yeah, sure.
Stuttering as an iceberg?
There you go. Joseph Sheehan, 1970. What is the stuttering iceberg, Bob?
Basically what Sheehan said, and this is talked about a lot, the notion of an iceberg, there's only a part of it you can actually see on the surface. The largest part of the iceberg is actually below the surface. And so when you consider stuttering as an iceberg, the notion is that when we look at the surface behaviors, the disfluencies, that really is only a small part of what actually constitutes the disorder of stuttering. There's a lot more that we can't see, and that really comprises the disorder of stuttering. So when we're simply looking at the surface behaviors, we're really missing a lot of the disorder.
Yeah, that is a classic one. Is there even one, an analogy to describe stuttering that would be number two? I'm not sure if there's one that is quite as big as that one.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a classic analogy like that that's probably as well known as the iceberg. I think there's others that are used, like, you know, trying to steer your car on an icy surface or things like that that are used a lot. But I think that probably the one that's the most classic and probably is referred to by many people in many contexts is probably the iceberg of stuttering.
So the stuttering iceberg, it's pretty clearly attributed to Joseph Sheehan, but most other analogies we're going to discuss today, or many of them, we really don't know who developed them, who was the first to say them. So as we go through the analogies, we might share where we found them or who contacted us with the analogy, but let's just make it very clear. We really don't know who was the first to say these things. Is that a good enough disclaimer, Bob?
Yeah, I think I'm trying to remember where it was. I was at a meeting, or I was talking to a colleague a number of years ago, and that person pointed out that you know, oftentimes you're at a meeting or you're somewhere and somebody's giving a presentation and they'll talk about something and you'll say, hey, that's my example or that's my analogy. And when you start thinking about it, it's like, you know, well, where did I first hear that? You know, and so I think we often try to be careful when we're using these to say, well, I first heard this from this place, but I'm not sure if many of these can ever be really tracked back to, you know, their original source, you know, the person that first thought of this or first said this was so and so, you know, and so I think that we have to be careful to say, well, this is where I heard it, but we're not saying that this is necessarily the first person who said it, so that we are being fair.
Yeah, I'm smiling here because every now and then at Stutter Talk, we actually get an email that will say something like, you know, I've been talking about the importance of talking about stuttering for years, sort of implying that they came up with the idea of talking about stuttering.
Yeah, right.
So we're never going to make everybody happy. But this is not an exhaustive list. So if we miss an analogy that you use or you've heard, please send us an email, stuttertalk@stuttertalk.com, because we'd love to hear some analogies from our listeners. And I think we've gotten as many as 15 or 20 analogies from listeners. And sometimes, like, we've gotten the Chinese finger trap two or three times, but, you know. So let's start off one. You mentioned one about swimming. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, this is one I heard from when Phil Schneider came to talk at our Illinois State Convention. And again, this is probably back in the maybe the late 90s, early part of the 2000s. I'm trying to think back now how long ago it was, but anyway, Phil came and talked at our state meeting, and he used an analogy that I use many times now. I've stolen this from Phil, and I think that it's Phil's, but maybe Phil got it from somebody else, I'm not sure. But he used the example of when he was talking about the way that people who stutter struggle with speech and why struggling with speech is not helpful. He used the example of a person that can't swim. What happens when a person who can't swim would fall in the water? The notion is, if something like that happens and you can't swim, the thing that you should do is you should simply let yourself relax and the body floats, you know, essentially the human body floats. But when you have this fear of what might happen if you fall in the water, this fear of drowning, what you tend to do is you thrash around, and in your attempts to not drown, you essentially drown because you're doing things that are sort of counterproductive to what you need to do. And so when the person who stutters is in a moment of stuttering and they start to struggle in an attempt to not stutter, they essentially are doing something similar to what a person who can't swim does when they find themselves, you know, in the water. They start to do these counterproductive behaviors that actually get themselves in more trouble, as opposed to something that would be like a counterintuitive thing. Let yourself sort of ease up and relax, and actually that will help you get out of the stuttering block rather than making the stuttering block worse.
Let's talk about one from Wendell Johnson from 1958. Johnson was a stutterer, sort of famously or infamously known for the diagnostogenic theory, which we won't get into today, but he also had some really smart coping ideas for stuttering that Charlie Osborne has turned me on to. So anyway, so Johnson had this analogy of stuttering being like the six blind men. What do you think of that one, Bob?
Well, I think that this one came actually, I believe this one's, if I'm not mistaken, this was from Eisenson's symposium book, I think it was, and again, I might be wrong about that, but this was, again, I think back around 1950s. The notion was that different people were looking at stuttering from a different point of view. Was it a physical problem? Was it a psychosocial problem? Was it a learning problem? Things like that. And so what Johnson was trying to point out was that depending on how you view the disorder of stuttering, you're going to be looking for certain things. So in other words, the idea is that the six blind men and the elephant, you know, the person that feels the leg says, well, an elephant is like a tree. The person that feels the tail says, well, an elephant is like a rope. person that feels the trunk says the elephant is like a snake. The person that feels the elephant sides as well, it's like a piece of leather or something like that. That's the way it was. The notion is that the part of this big problem, if you will, stuttering, if you're only looking at a certain part of it, then you're not necessarily getting the full picture of what this thing is. Mm. And so I believe that was, and again, this is, you know, you're asking me to go back and think about stuff that I haven't looked at or thought about in a number of years, but I believe that this was used in a textbook or in a chapter or somewhere when they were trying to explain why different people, like again, Johnson, Robert West, people who were sort of the classic researchers in stuttering and had different views of the disorder, saying, well, you know, we're all looking at different parts of this disorder and therefore we're not really looking at this whole thing. We're looking at our leg and our trunk and our tail and our tusk when it's actually a bigger thing.
This is Stutter Talk. Peter Reitzis here with Dr. Robert Quiesel talking about stuttering analogies from people who stutter, from researchers, from speech pathologists, gotten them from all over the place. And, you know, the six blind men remind me a little bit of something Nan Bernstein Ratner wrote in 2005 with one of her, I think, seminal papers on evidence-based practice. She wrote the, quote, familiar analogy of the drunk seeking his keys only under the lamppost because the light is better there, end quote. And, you know, that speaks to me where it's so easy to measure moments of stuttering to decide, you know, was treatment helpful or not? Let's just measure the moments of stuttering. Did he stutter 10 times on Wednesday and 9 times on Thursday? Oh, the person's better. So yeah, just because it's easier to see or easier to measure doesn't mean it's the best way to look at the problem. Do you think that's fair there, Bob?
Oh yeah. Again, that's also one that I use a lot. Not just talking about the disorder of stuttering, but I think that again, I'm going to get in trouble with this one probably as well. But one of the reasons I think why SLPs have been so drawn to the disorder of swallowing is because it's much more, swallowing is a much more tangible disorder. In other words, does the person swallow or don't they? I mean, that's something you can essentially observe. You know, swallowing is a reflex. When you get into things like language processing, a person's had a stroke and they're having problems with language, understanding language or using language, and you get into the notion of, well, is that person processing the signal properly to be able to make sense out of the things that they're hearing? Are they encoding language properly to be able to say the things that they need to say? Those things are very hard to observe and measure. So therefore, it's when you're trying to prove to a third party payer, for example, that your treatment is helping or making a difference, we tend to go to the things that are easier to see and easier to measure and more tangible. And so again, it's easier to see and measure fluency. It's harder to measure whether a person's feelings about speech have changed, their attitudes have changed, their willingness to enter into speaking situations have changed. And so yeah, so again, we are very much like the drunk who lost his keys, and we're looking for them under the street lamp when the keys may actually be halfway down the block.
Mm. And sometimes the keys move around a bit too. So we've talked about Wendell Johnson and Joseph Sheehan, who were those pioneers in speech language pathology. Let's move on to the second wave of people, which would include Gene Cooper. And in 1977 or 1974, I guess, he made an analogy between stuttering and alcoholism. Could you explain that, Bob? I'll just read one quick quote and then you can explain it from 1977. Okay. Quote, "It appears to me that just as alcoholics are assisted in becoming non-drinking controlled alcoholics, so are stutterers assisted in becoming fluent controlled stutterers. Was Gene Cooper onto something there, Bob?
Yeah. I think that's probably one of those analogies that worked better in the 70s than it would today, because there's always the fear you're going to offend somebody when you use that kind of an analogy. But the idea there is, again, the notion that people have often said, you know, once a stutterer, always a stutterer. The notion being that people stutter because there's a difference. There's a physical difference in us. You know, we are different in some way. It's not that we're not trying hard enough. It's not that we're lazy, we're stupid. It's just that our systems are different. Our systems are prone to fluency breakdown. And so therefore the things that we learn in therapy really are ways to manage that fluency breakdown. It doesn't go away as a result of therapy. We just manage it. Just like a person who is an alcoholic has a physical difference, the way that their body reacts to alcohol is different. And therefore, when the person who is an alcoholic goes through rehab, they are not cured of that problem. If they start to drink again, then that's not good. So that they are not cured of alcoholism. They simply have learned to manage their alcoholism. And so I think that, you know, if you simply look at it from that perspective, I think it's a very good, analogy. It's a very apt analogy.
Yeah. And there was a study from 2003 by Anderson and Felsenfeld, and I'll just quote something they wrote, quote, "Interestingly, four of the six participants made an analogy to being a recovered alcoholic." So it seems that they found that in just this one study that a bunch of the subjects compared, just like Gene Cooper did, stuttering to alcoholism. And I bet the people who stuttered did not go back and read Gene Cooper's papers from 1974. I just think it makes a lot of sense.
Right. Exactly.
So, Bob, let's touch upon one of yours. Actually, it's one of my favorites. So could you briefly remind the listeners about your burning house analogy?
Yeah, this was one where there was a response on the Facebook page where somebody, I think, either misunderstood what I was trying to say or something. But again, when we were doing the show on freezing a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the notion of what is freezing like to the person who stutters, or how might the person who stutters view freezing? Because the notion there is that it's a counterintuitive sort of a thing. You're saying to the person who stutters, you know, I want you to do something that you've been trying to avoid for your whole life, something that you find very unpleasant. And when I try to explain freezing to my clients, to parents of clients, for example, I say that freezing is kind of like asking a person in a burning building to stay inside that burning room, and before they're allowed to leave the burning room, to do an inventory of the furniture, the wall coverings, what the room looks like before they're allowed to leave that burning room. The notion being that, you know, when you're in a panic state, your thought processes are, I just want to get out of here. You know, you're not interested in taking time, you know, to do something that doesn't make sense. Why would I want to sit here in this room that's burning and look around and say, well, there's a couple of chairs, there's a couch, there's a couple of tables, you know. But that's essentially what we're asking the person to do when we say to them, I want you to freeze. It's a counterintuitive thing, and I guess the place where the analogy falls down is, well, yeah, that there really wouldn't be any purpose in staying in that burning room. But it's more like, what are the emotions associated with freezing like, and why does it seem so counterintuitive to the person who stutters when you ask them to do something like that?
I think that's a great analogy for stuttering. And even treatment too, because a big part of treatment is having to think about what you're doing. And, you know, I literally think I spent 20 years panicking when I stuttered or when I felt I was going to stutter. And I just didn't know how to think about stuttering objectively. You know, it was all...
Well,
just panic.
Right, and I think one of the other things is when you talk to a person who stutters, who hasn't had therapy, and you say to them, what do you do when you stutter? Tell me about your stuttering. They usually can't tell you anything about what their stuttering is, because they've spent their whole life trying to run out of that burning house, if you will. In other words, you know, the whole nature of stuttering, at least I believe, is that it's either trying to not get into that burning house, or once you're in it, to get out of it. You know, you don't want to be in that moment. You know, the moment of stuttering is a very unpleasant place to be. And so this idea of learning the skills to sort of stay in that moment and sort of analyze what you're doing, again, even if you've had therapy, it's a very, very hard thing to do. It's a very counterintuitive thing to do. Yet it's one of the most important skills that we can teach our clients who stutter.
Agreed. So let me throw out one of mine. It seems that over the years, I've compared stuttering to weight loss or weight gain quite a bit. And one of the ones I think is pretty easy to make where people start to get it a bit is, I think there's an assumption by a lot of people that it should be fairly easy to deal with stuttering. And when you say to people, like if you're in a room with 25, 50 people, and in our field it's typically women because most speech pathologists are women, and you say, you know, how many people here would like to lose 5, 10, 20 pounds? And I'm always the first to raise my hand, and usually 95% of the room raises their hand. And it's like, well, why haven't you done it? If it were easy, everybody in the room would lose 5, 10, 15, 20 pounds, but it's not easy at all. I would love to lose 20 pounds. I know how to do it, but I'm not willing to do what it takes to lose the 20 pounds. I mean, it's just that simple. Doesn't make me happy to say it, but it's true. I don't know what you think of the weight loss analogy, Bob.
No, I think that works. Again, I think anything you can do to help a person that doesn't stutter understand stuttering in a different way, and that's why I use these analogies. I use them a lot with parents of kids who stutter, you know, people who don't stutter. The idea is that, how do you understand this? It's like, well, why does my kid not just do those things that seem to be so easy for me? You know, why does he just not work harder at being fluent? And then when you say to a parent, well, you know how to lose weight, why don't you just work harder at losing weight? And the parent goes, oh.
Yeah.
And that's one of those bing moments where the parent goes, oh, you've now helped me to understand stuttering in a different context, that I have a much easier time relating to. And therefore from that point on, the parent suddenly views stuttering totally differently. And that is such a powerful thing, because that's what we're trying to do for people who don't stutter, is say, you have to be able to get what this disorder is. The person's experience of stuttering is not your experience of disfluency. So let's use some kind of an analogy that will help you to put it in a context that you will understand.
Yeah, and just as we're talking here, it occurred to me that I know somebody who used, they made an analogy to stuttering to help themselves better get it. But at one point they said, I think stuttering is a lot like me and heights. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to get on an airplane. I don't want to face it. I don't want to go meet with somebody to have to learn how to face heights. I'm just not going to deal with it. You know, and they said, yeah. And it sounds like that's like your experience with stuttering.
Because again, the thing that we're trying to do is help people who don't stutter to understand something that they've never had experience with. They sit and look at it from the outside. You know, just like again, the example you gave of fear of heights. If you don't have a fear of heights, you say to somebody, "Well, I don't understand. Why do you have a problem flying? Why do you have a problem going up in an elevator? Why do tall buildings bother you? Whatever it might be." You know, I don't get it. I, you know, it, that does that. That's not my experience, and therefore I can't understand why that would be a problem. But if you can say to them, well, you know, do you have a fear of spiders? Do you have a fear of whatever it might be? And they go, well, yeah, I do. Then it's like, okay, well, how about spiders? Hmm. And then suddenly they go, oh, okay. And anything you can do like that to help a person say, oh, okay, yeah, there is something that I experience that's different. And that my experience then helps me to understand your experience. Even though you and I have had different experiences, we can now understand each other because we have something that, even though it's not the same, it's similar, and therefore we now can understand each other better, and therefore we can move forward.
Let's discuss one more before the break. This is one from Larry Malt. I don't have a year for this one, but he's currently a researcher, so it's fairly recent, and here's what he wrote, quote, "The analogy of a pimple that appears on our face during our teenage years to us. It's huge and eye-catching, and we're sure everyone is staring at it, but in reality, few people ever notice it. Simply put, stuttering isn't that important to most people who don't stutter." I think Larry Malt's exactly right there. At least for me, my stuttering was a heck of a lot more important for me than to most other listeners. The problem is, every now and then there's someone who's like, oh, dude, you got a big zit on your face. So,
right.
You know.
Right. And there's also sort of a variation on that I often use with my students that relates to disclosure of stuttering as well. And it's the example of when you wake up in the morning and you have that big zit. And the notion is that you have a choice then of either going out that day and sort of commenting on it. You know, gee, I got woke up this morning. I have this big zit on my forehead, and I tried to do something about it, and I couldn't. Or going around all day with the zit on your forehead, and every time you encounter somebody, they see you've got this big zit, and they don't know whether to say anything about it or not. So then the person you're interacting with feels uncomfortable. Whereas when you comment on it and acknowledge that it's there and you realize it's there, then it puts that other person at ease because they know that you know that it's there and it doesn't bother you, and therefore it doesn't bother them either. So the same thing when we try to pretend that our stuttering's not there and we don't let our listener know that it doesn't bother us and they shouldn't let it bother them, it's like, you know, failure, you know, be willing to acknowledge stuttering helps put our listener at ease, just like acknowledging our zit helps to put the observer of that zit at ease as well.
I like that a lot. So let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to speak about more stuttering analogies, including some really good ones that listeners left at the Stutter Talk Facebook group.
My name is Ruben Schaff, and I'm a person who's stutters. I'm really excited to announce a new National Stuttering Association TWIST chapter that Rita Thurman and I started in Raleigh, North Carolina. TWIST is Teens Who Stutter, and it's a support group for teens and their families to come and share information and support about stuttering. We meet in Raleigh on the first Wednesday of every month, and you can get more information at the NSA website at westutter.org.
Yo, 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 what's up, y'all? This is Taro from Our Time, and you are listening to the hottest station in town, Stutter Talk.
Welcome back to Stutter Talk, Stutter Talk at StutterTalk.com. Peter Wrights is here with Dr. Robert Quisel at Western Illinois University talking about stuttering analogies. Bob, is stuttering like pornography?
I think that when I'm trying to explain to students, to my students, how difficult it is to try to define stuttering, one of the quotes I use, and I don't think this is my quote, but I've used it for many, many years. In fact, it's probably the quote that I use that gets cited nearly every year. We have our annual Christmas party in our department, and the second year grads who are going to be going off and doing their off campus internships sort of do this, you know, final skit before they leave. And this is the quote that typically is cited most often by me, and that is, stuttering is like pornography. It's hard to define, but you know it when you see it. And I think that the point that I try to make about that is that what I say is that there's something about stuttering. It's either the way people who stutter talk or the amount of the behavior that you observe where you can tell that a person stutters. I mean, there's something about our speech that's just different, you know, and I say to the students, you know, when did you first figure out that I was a person who stutters? You know, because I don't always mention it right at the outset of my class. I don't go in the first day and say, hi, I'm Bob Quisel and I stutter. It does come out at some point in my classes, but I don't just go out there in the first day and make a big deal about it. But I ask my students, well, when did you first figure out that I was a person who stutters, you know, and they'll say, well, blah, 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 you know, they'll give these sort of, you know, awkward answers. Well, I don't know, at some point, you know, and I say to them, you know, you can be honest with me. It doesn't bother me because clearly there's something about what I do that's different. Because that's why I'm a person who stutters, you know. Right. And we talk about that. But there's something you saw in my speech. It was different. Mm-hmm. And again, but it's hard for them to explain it. And then I say, stuttering is like pornography. It's hard to define, but you know it when you see it. And they all kind of chuckle, ha, ha, ha. And then about a year later, you know, they quote me at the end of semester party in December, so.
Well, this has sort of annoyed some people I know, but I have made the point over the years that if you want to know if a child stutters or not, put them in a sandbox with other kids, because the other kids will tell you. I know we talk a lot in a professional way about differential diagnosis, but sometimes you just know it when you see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and often the reason that parents will bring their kids to our clinics, for example, is they will say, well, I was driving my kids somewhere and I noticed, you know, or I was with a group of children and I noticed that my child was behaving in a way that was different from the other children. And it's like, you know, there was just something different. Well, what was it was different? I'm not really sure, but there was just something about the way he was talking or she was talking that was different. And it's, you know, if we could easily define stuttering, then we would. But there are certain things about stuttering that are just different. And so, as they say, it's hard to define, but you know it when you see it.
I've never had a parent of a preschooler bring in their child and have the child not stutter. So every single time a parent of a preschooler has said, I think my child's stuttering, they're right. I don't know if you've had a similar experience or not, Bob.
Yeah, well, yeah. And I think, because again, the notion of stuttering in preschoolers can either be a chronic or a temporary condition, and so therefore certainly they can bring a child in, the child is showing all the behaviors of stuttering, but if we do good early intervention as possible, the child will ultimately not stutter. But again, that's different. We're talking about a preschooler versus somebody who's, you know, an older child or an adolescent who's past those critical stages. But that's probably a whole nother show. So,
well, there was several papers, or probably many papers, at the stuttering homepage that has stuttering analogies in them. So let me bring up a few. There's one by Megan Nielsen, and here's the quote. Having a stutter is a bit like driving on ice when you're inexperienced. You know where you want to go, and you try to make the car go there, but it's easy to skid into disaster. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I would even argue that it's a bit like driving on ice when you are an experienced driver.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I may have heard this example for the first time from Peter Ramig probably 20 plus years ago. Again, he was talking about this notion of, you know, driving your car on ice and how you have to, you know, drive differently when you're driving on ice versus when you're driving on dry pavement. And again, it was one of those things where, yeah, you know, that just makes so much sense because, again, if we get back to the notion of stuttering being a loss of control, when you are driving on ice, there is a much greater risk of losing control of your vehicle. Therefore, you have to be a lot more vigilant when you're driving on ice. And therefore, the way you drive is different, just like the way the person who stutters talks differently because they're talking on ice. And actually, one of the other things that I use with that ice example is walking on ice. Because what I say to my students is, think about if you're walking on the ice and you slip and fall, what's the first thing that you do when you fall on the ice? You look around and see if people saw you, right? In other words, you're not really worried, did I break my ankle? Did I break my wrist? The first thing is usually, did somebody see me? Because what typically happens is when you fall, when you lose control and fall on the ice, you feel embarrassed because you've lost control. And so therefore that reaction is very much like what the person who stutters experiences when they lose control of speech. And there's often some social penalty associated with that as well. Because people see you fall on the ice, they'll often laugh or that kind of stuff. You know, particularly if you haven't gotten hurt, they'll sort of laugh. Ha ha, isn't that funny, you know? And I think that again, if you understand the idea of if you fall on the ice, then what typically happens is the next, when you get up from having fallen, when you start to walk again, it's a lot more cautious because you don't want to fall again. Well, think of the kid who stutters. He or she, you know, essentially is talking on ice. They are more prone to slip and fall. And oftentimes that slipping and falling is associated by social penalty. And therefore they become a much more cautious talker, if you will. And those behaviors that are part of not falling, if you will, not stuttering, become part of the way that person talks. And so it isn't a surprise that the child who stutters, when we look at their speech motor behavior, for example, they have a different pattern of speech motor behavior than the kid who doesn't stutter, because their way of talking has been based on not stuttering as opposed to simply talking normally or talking fluently.
I like that, and I forgot all about this one. Where in the past I've described the analogy is with stuttering and voluntary stuttering and skiing, where somebody says, "Well, why should I use voluntary stuttering? I stutter all the time." And it's like, well, with skiing, you know, somebody says, "Well, why should I fall? I'm a beginner. I'm going to fall anyway." And it's like, well, when you learn how to fall safely, you don't fear falling so much and you can focus on skiing.
Right.
So literally the first thing I was taught when I went skiing was to fall. You know, and it made total sense. No one questioned it. But a lot of people question voluntary stuttering.
Yes.
So I have to wonder if we did a study on this, Bob, if more people would be afraid of voluntary stuttering than falling on skis.
I'm not sure.
I think more people would be afraid of voluntary stuttering. I think they'd rather fall on ice, you know, fall on snow. Okay. So moving right along, I'm going to have Walter Manning on the show in a week or two. So I'm going to ask him about stuttering and kayaking, his great analogy. So we'll just leave that on the table for now. But, Walter Manning has one where he calls it the seal analogy, S-E-A-L, or swim among the sharks. Do you want to take that one, Bob?
Oh, I'm not sure if I can do that one justice, but let me see if I can think about that one. Navy SEALs, again, who are learn these specialized skills, learn how to swim among sharks. In other words, they actually, part of their training is to learn how to be in the water with sharks around them. And so the notion is, again, you're in a situation that's very frightening, and you learn to focus on the task at hand as opposed to the things around you, which in this case would be sharks. And so if the person learns to focus on the skills that they need, the working on managing stuttering as opposed to the fears of stuttering, then again it helps the person to be better able to use the skills that they're learning when they're focused on the speech as opposed to the feelings or the fears that are associated with stuttering. The one I like that I think we should talk about is Kristen Pelczarski's about the grapefruit.
Great. So Kristen Pelczarski, did I say her name right? Pelczarski. She had an article at the Stuttering homepage, "What Does a Grapefruit Have to Do with Stuttering? An Analogy for Understanding the Experience of Covert Stuttering." So what did she mean, Bob?
Well, again, this is one I hadn't seen before, but it's really, really great. It's one of these ones I'm gonna steal now and be using in the future. But, you know, Kristen was talking about the notion of if you had to carry a grapefruit with you, you know, it's not big, you know, it's not heavy, something you can hold in your hand, and it would be sort of there, you know, it wouldn't be fun to have to carry a grapefruit around with you all the time, but most people could manage to carry a grapefruit with them. But imagine if you had to hide that grapefruit. In other words, you had it with you, but you had to make sure that no one could see that. Okay, so therefore, whenever you entered a room, you had to make sure that you were in a position where you could hold your hand in such a way that no one in the room could see any part of the grapefruit. You have to, you know, hold your hand a certain way. Or you would always have to be vigilant and make sure that no one could see that grapefruit. How much more effort it would take for you if you always had to hide that grapefruit? And the notion there is, think of the person who's trying to be a covert stutterer, who's trying to hide the fact that they stutter. If you have to exert so much more effort, whereas if you simply just simply let the fact that you stutter out and be more open about it, it really takes less effort to be open about stuttering than it does to hide stuttering.
Oh, I love it, especially with my covert stuttering background. I think that's just wonderful.
I had never seen that before, but I just love it too. I think it's a really wonderful, wonderful example. Again, it can be used with both, you know, parents who stutter, kids who stutter, and I think the other thing too is that it also helps people understand that notion of putting the amount of extra effort you use when you're trying to hide stuttering that you don't really realize that you are putting into keeping your stuttering hidden.
So on the Stutter Talk Facebook page, we got some good ones. Let's try to burn through a few of them. Lisette Wessling, she wrote, "This may be too British, but I've often thought that in very stressful speaking situations, strict fluency shaping techniques are about as much use as a chocolate teapot. They sometimes just don't work." No argument here, Lisette. What do you think, Bob?
Yeah, well, I guess the only thing I would question is the notion of when she says they sometimes just don't work. I would question when does a chocolate teapot work, I guess. But yes, I think that was a very good, sort of a very fun analogy that she shared with us. Yes.
When does a chocolate teapot work? A meta-analysis of fluency shaping. Okay, moving right along. Simon Richardson wrote, quote, "Fluency is as slippery as a dog in wet tile." yeah, we're chasing fluency. Not we, as in we, but many people chase fluency.
Right.
A couple people have compared stuttering to the engine of a car. Ari Gershanovich, who I think, I might be wrong, but I think he was the first one to refer to you as Bob the Expert. I think it was Ari. Anyway, so he...
who to blame now, then, I guess.
So he might not have been the first, though. I just want to be clear about that. Okay, so he wrote, and I think I tinkered with the language here a little bit because English is not his first language. So R.A. wrote, quote, "The best analogy I found was when our car gearbox or transmission gets broken. The car behaves like normal until I feel in the middle of the road that I don't have control over the car. It didn't take a lot of time until I felt control again, but I was terrified to drive with the car again." That's a lot like stuttering, right?
Uh-huh. And again, one of the ones I use to try to explain to parents of kids who stutter, and again to my students as well, is try to imagine if when you were learning to drive, if the car that you learned to drive in, for some unknown reason, every so often would simply veer to the right. Okay. In other words, your car was different. The way you learned to drive was different. And imagine that you're driving along and suddenly your car just veers to the right. And you didn't know when it was going to happen. It would just happen at, you know, intermittent, unexpected times. And how would that have affected the way that you drove? Wouldn't you probably favor the left a little bit? You probably would hold the steering wheel more tightly. And that's essentially what the child who stutters goes through when they're learning how to speak. Their car works differently. And so therefore the notion of a person reacting to stuttering makes sense, because the kid who stutters has these intermittent moments of fluency breakdown that other kids don't, and therefore their speech motor behavior is different because they've been learning to drive a different car.
Mm. And it's so great how so many of us stutterers have similar thoughts, because there's a website, a stuttering community website, and somebody made a post by the name of Kwesi, K-W-E-S-I, and they were talking about this idea of stuttering being like a car, and they wrote, "Imagine your friends and family not having this problem. Imagine having to get into the car every day. Imagine everyone telling you how to do it. Imagine everyone not understanding you and how on earth you can't do this simple skill. Imagine the traffic queue behind you whenever you experience this bad clutch control." I mean, that's great.
Yeah, yep.
So a bunch of people have written, actually, before we get into the Chinese finger trap, have you ever, a good friend of yours you've done a lot of work with him, Scott Yaris, when I saw him present last, maybe 9 months ago or so, he does this great thing where he has the audience pair off into two and they do a writing exercise. Have you seen Scott do that?
Oh, yes. I've seen Scott do that many times. Yes.
Now,
so
I don't know if Scott was the first to come up with it, because since then I've heard a few people mention it. But would you share what Scott does?
Yeah. Again, this is one of those things where Scott tries to use this to illustrate the notion of how people respond to loss of control. Yes, people pair off. One person is group A, one person is group B, and the notion is that you are living in a place where it's very important to have good handwriting, and so your job is to write your name. So start writing your name, and then the other person's job is to bump you in the elbow every so often, and so you just keep on writing, and then the person bumps you, and your goal is to maintain your good handwriting throughout this intermittent bumping of your arm. And then Scott asks the audience, "Tell me what happened when we're getting your arm bumped." And people say, I wrote slower, I wrote faster, I tensed up, I grabbed my pencil more tightly. The notion being that I reacted to this loss of control. And Scott says, well, when the child is speaking and stutters, they are experiencing loss of control, and they talk slower, they talk faster. And some people say, well, I just stopped writing. And Scott says, well, why then do you think kids who stutter try to change the way they talk when they experience loss of control? And again, it's one of those moments, one of those aha moments for the audience, and they go, oh.
Yeah.
And again, that's why analogies can be so powerful, because people say, oh, I never thought about it that way, but now I've had an experience that helps me to understand at some level what it might be like to stutter, although it's not the same, but it helps the person to understand stuttering differently. And yeah. it's one of the first things that Scott does in his workshops typically as well.
It was a very powerful moment, and you heard people saying things like, "Well, I was so worried about getting, you know, my arm hit that I wasn't focusing on writing. I was just worrying about it, you know." And
yeah,
that's very powerful. A bunch of people over the years have talked about the Chinese finger trap analogy. I mean, I can remember 15 years ago or more, Lee Caggiano talking about this. I wouldn't be surprised if people like Kristen Camella and Nina Reeves talk about it. I mean, I can't say that for a fact, but it just seems like this is out there. So what's the Chinese finger trap analogy?
Well, again, if you think of it, I mean, I remember playing with Chinese finger traps when I was a kid, so we're talking about, well, and never mind. Anyway, but you know, it's the device that, you know, you put your fingers in, and if you pull hard, your fingers get stuck. And it's sort of this webbed thing. It's like a webbed tube, and you put your fingers in either end, and if you try to pull your fingers out, if you pull hard, it tightens up. And you can't get your fingers out, and the way to get your fingers out is to simply pull them out in a very gentle way. And so again, it's one of these counterintuitive sort of a things, you know, where, you know, you typically, when you're stuck in some place, you pull harder, and for the Chinese finger trap, the harder you pull, the harder it is to get your fingers loose. And so again, it's very much like stuttering. You know, if you're in a moment of stuttering, the harder you struggle, the more you push, the more you are likely to get into more trouble. Whereas if you simply let yourself sort of ease out of that moment, reduce some of the effort and struggle, you're more likely to be able to get through that moment. Which again is one of the lessons that we try to teach our clients in therapy.
Yeah, I mean, so many of these are related. I mean, I was going through different websites, and somebody had left in the comment section at the Stuttering Brain blog, where they mention the Chinese finger trap, and then they talk about stuttering as like floating in water. Just like you said, if you panic and start thrashing around, you'll sink. The same person wrote in the comment section at the Stuttering Brain about stuttering being like walking across a beam. And again, I'm quoting here. If it's on the floor, you'd have no trouble. If it's 500 feet in the air, you'd probably freak out and fall. I mean, that's great, right?
Oh yeah. In fact, again, that's one I can often use with my students, because many of the students that I teach have had experience as gymnasts when they were younger. And I still say to them, you know, when you first learned to do the balance beam, did they have the balance beam, you know, up, you know, 6 to 8 feet in the air? And they go, no. It's like, well, you learn the techniques on the ground, right? It's like, yeah, well, why is that? Well, because, you know, there's the fear of falling. You want, and so that often works for students. And that's one, again, the analogy of the beam and raising the beam, up in the air is one I probably heard when I was a student. So again, we're talking about ancient history here, but I believe that I heard that one when I was probably, an undergrad or a master's student. So we're talking probably back in the 1970s. So that one has been around for a long time. That may be one of those Van Riper or Johnson or one of those classic analogies.
Let's just remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk. Bob Quisel and Peter writes this. Bob, I always introduce you, so I should let the listeners know who are still listening to this episode that I am a speech-language pathologist in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and a person who stutters. You know, just to diverge for a second here, Bob, I'm reading a book on World War I, and the author made a really great point in the introduction to the book where she was explaining why she didn't go into teaching. And she basically said, look, when you teach, you have a captive audience, so they have to turn the page because they want a grade. If you really want to know if what you're talking about means anything, write a book, because no one has to read it. You know? And I think so, if anyone's still listening to Stutter Talk, this is, it's a testament to the fact that no one's holding a gun to your head. You're listening because you're either enjoying this or you just think it can't get any worse, but you just want to keep listening. So, yeah, you're not a captive audience. Okay. So one of my students, 8 years old, third grader, I think it was my very first year as a speech pathologist, he made a great point where in speech class we were working on rate control pausing, so slowing down the rate of your speech, and pull out so that when you stutter, you can move through the stutters. And he said that pullouts are like an emergency brake. When the pausing doesn't work, you throw in the emergency brake and you work through the stutter. And I still use that. I thought he really understood what we were doing. Mm-hmm. Thought that was great.
And one of the things I think that's very important is, and that is that, you know, it's often important if clients come up with their own analogies. I mean, because again, this is what works for the person. And so I think that maybe some of the things that you and I have been talking about here in this show will lead to other people thinking about things. Well, you know, their analogies are not exactly like what I thought about, but this is how I think of stuttering, and it's more like what works for someone. There are no perfect analogies, I don't think, but it's anything that helps somebody to understand stuttering differently or put it in the right context, and that's why these are very, very helpful, I think.
I think you're exactly right. So Voon Pang, a listener, a speech pathologist in New Zealand, he wrote, quote, "One of the kids I work with, 10 years old, mentioned in the initial assessment that to help with his stuttering, he would speak quicker. So, quote, you're trying to pull off a Band-Aid quickly to try and reduce the pain. Slowing down actually makes it hurt more." I don't think I agree with that, but I'm glad that the child is thinking about speaking and stuttering.
Well, but see, I wonder if that's one of those cases where you think about the notion of the reason why you may want to talk quicker is because oftentimes when you are sort of again staying in that moment, if you will, it is more painful. Part of the reason why we sort of rush through stuttering moments is because we are trying to sort of get through it quickly and make the pain less severe, less intense, and so maybe that analogy works differently in the idea that, well, yes, it is not as pleasant to take the Band-Aid off slowly, but actually that's going to give you more benefit in the long run. Although I don't know quite how that sort of works. But I think it kind of works in the notion of why we might be tempted to rush through our moments of stuttering, because staying with them does tend to be a little bit more painful, I think.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Mark Bulger wrote something that is very similar to the Scott Yarris handwriting analogy we just discussed. So Mark wrote, quote, "There's a man following you around every day, all day, and he has a switch stick in his hand. Every so often, as you walk and put your right foot down, he hits you across the behind with the switch. Not enough to injure, just enough to sting. After a year or two of that, a few thousand whacks with the switch across your bottom, how would it affect your walking?" That's good, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. Heck yes. and again, I would argue it would probably take a lot less than a year or two of that. It would probably only take a few weeks of that before people would start to walk differently. But yeah, I think that's a really good analogy.
So as I'm going through my notes here, I mentioned a few things from the comment section of the Stuttering Brain, and then I see that Elliot Old wrote the same three things: a Chinese finger trap, walking across a beam, floating in the water. So I'm not sure if... So anyway, I just wanted to mention his name and that he did send those. So as long as we're talking about Scott Yarris, Bob, he has a bucket analogy. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, this is one I think that Scott developed a number of years ago when he was working with Dave Hammer at the Children's Hospital, and now with Craig Holman. The, the notion of when you think about the different things that may exacerbate stuttering in kids who stutter, the notion that, you know, stuttering's not there all the time, and but again, to get parents to think about like why children may stutter more sometimes than others or whatever, there are a number of factors that affect children stuttering. And so what Scott says to the parents is think about stuttering as being sort of like a bucket. And so there are different kinds of stresses, if you will. There are things like the children's motor skills and language skills that are sort of inherent sorts of things. And so those are things that sort of are like water in the bucket, if you will. You then add other things that might be going on in the child's environment. There might be time pressure, other sorts of demands. There might be school pressure, those sorts of things. And what happens is that all these different things get added into the bucket, like more and more water gets added into the bucket. And then at some point the bucket overflows, and that's essentially what leads to the stuttering. And at different times there'll be different amounts of these different waters, if you will be in the bucket. And so you'll get, you know, that's why stuttering tends to vary, because again there'll be different things going on. And so the bucket often is at a point where it doesn't overflow, but at other times it does. And so it's sort of like helping the parents to understand that there are a lot of factors that influence stuttering, and that helps them to understand that that's why stuttering is a variable disorder, because the many things that can influence stuttering also vary over the course of, you know, both the short term and the long term. And again, Scott has a really nice example of that at the Stuttering Center of Western Pennsylvania website.
So let's talk about a few that we've mentioned on air before. One of my favorites, I must have mentioned it 5, 6, 10 times on air, is Woody Starkweather from 1998, where he wrote, "In fluency shaping, there is much unnecessary effort used to speak fluently, and many clients just realize that the cure is worse than the disease." I love that. The cure is worse than the disease. What do you think of that one?
Oh yeah. And again, I mean, many people will say that they find it harder to do the things they need to do to manage their fluency, to be fluent all the time, than they do to either just stutter or to use more of an easy type of stuttering or whatever. And so yeah, oftentimes it is like the things that you have to do, the effort you need to put in for using fluency shaping skills are just as effortful as either stuttering or voluntary stuttering or something like that.
Now here's something that's a little bit similar. Somebody wrote in, her name is Ruth Mead, and here's what she wrote, quote, "When I'm speaking spontaneously and well, it's like my speech is like a windmill powered by the wind. Everything is easy breezy. However, when I try too hard to speak well, thinking of when to take a breath, how to shape my mouth, how to keep flow going, it's like the windmill trying to turn itself rather than being turned easily and automatically by the wind." Can I take first shot at this one, Bob?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not in love with this analogy. I mean, to some extent, it's saying don't think too much. So like I liked Woody Starkweather's angle a little bit more, where he's saying, you know, this specific type of strict fluency shaping might be worse than the disease. But what Ruth Mead wrote about the windmill, I mean, I'm uncomfortable with this idea of don't think. And maybe I am over-summarizing it. What do you think, Bob?
Well, you know, as I say, I think that it's the notion of what exactly are we talking about when we're talking about overthinking your stuttering. Certainly what you want to try to do is maximize a person's ability to simply talk, you know, if you will. But there are going to be those times where you're going to get stuck. I mean, that's the nature of stuttering. And so I think it's a matter perhaps of helping the person to realize that it's not like you want to let your mind blank out totally, that you want to be willing to focus on what you're doing. If you do have those moments where things begin to break down, you start to get stuck, don't run from those moments. But again, you don't want to be so vigilant that you are constantly worrying about, am I talking at the right rate? Am I using my easy onsets, my light contacts, whatever it might be? And so there's sort of a balance between too much and too little, I think. And I think that's often what all of us strive for, and certainly we strive for with our clients, is how do we find that balance of the right amount of vigilance to be able to speak in a way that's good, smooth, one of those lifelong challenges, I suppose.
Sure, sure. So there's one I said on the Fluency Shaping show with Joe Klein a few weeks ago that I really like, where I basically said that choosing speech therapy or speech therapy program is analogous to choosing a Mexican restaurant. So you walk in and you look around and you want to know who's eating there. You know, so you go into a Mexican restaurant. I want to eat at the Mexican restaurant where there's a lot of Mexicans eating there. You know, I go to a Thai restaurant. I want to look around and see people from Thailand there. You know, then I know the food's probably good. So, you know, there is, I think, some logic that if you go to a treatment program, are the speech pathologists there people who stutter? Do you think that's fair, or do you think that's going too far?
No. As I say, I think that the person doesn't have to be somebody who stutters. Okay,
I agree with you. Yes,
right. The person has to demonstrate that they understand stuttering. So when somebody says, essentially, when we get rid of your stuttering, everything will be wonderful, then I think that is a suggestion of the person who's saying, you know, this is the best Mexican food in town, but everybody eating there is from Macomb or so. Anyway, I don't know. Anyway, you know, the notion there is that if the person doesn't really know doesn't know that much about Mexican food, then yeah, you're going to maybe question that. Their only experience of Mexican food is that they've had people tell them about it or something like that. Yeah. So I think that the notion there is, does the person have enough experience with what they're doing at a certain level to be able to explain it in a way that goes beyond just the more surface kinds of ways of looking at it?
Which, of course, brings us to an analogy I've heard many times, which was sent to me by Rosie Matthews, that stuttering is like an onion. Where she wrote, stuttering is like an onion. Just like the many layers of skin on an onion, there are many layers to a stuttering disorder. As we identify and address the layers, they can be peeled away one at a time. Communication becomes easier and better as the onion sheds its skin. And of course she says, you know, she can't take credit for this one. That works. I mean, it's not one I use a lot, but it makes sense.
Oh yeah. And again, that's one, I'm trying to remember where I first heard that one, but that one's been around for a while. But yeah, because I think the notion of an onion is, you often don't think of an onion as having layers necessarily. But yeah, I mean, an onion has many, many layers. And so oftentimes peeling an onion is quite a daunting task. And so I think that whole idea of having to get through all these multiple layers, I think that, yeah, the notion of peeling an onion works quite well.
So let's just cover one last analogy. And again, this is Stutter Talk. Peter writes this with Dr. Robert Quiesel. And this is one from Steve Marchand, a longtime listener and friend of the show. And he says, do you remember the last time you needed to do a home improvement project and found your extension cord in a tangled mess? You proceeded to untangle it, but quickly became frustrated. Because of your frustration and sense of urgency to complete your task, you found yourself pulling and yanking on the cord, hoping you will be successful. How did this work out for you? Good question, right? How's that working for you? It's a classic question. Steve's right, right?
Yeah. Again, that one also works. Again, you know, you're faced with a task and you try to rush, you try to push and get yourself in more trouble. So again, it's very much like other examples that we've used in the show, you know, and again, it helps people understand when you try to rush through things, when you try to push through things, when you're trying to do what seems to be the right thing, it actually gets you in more trouble than simply taking some time and sort of looking at how did this cord get tangled, where are all the tangles, and when you then take the time to sort of follow the pathway, it actually gets you a much better end result, even though it may take a bit longer.
Well, Bob, have we missed any analogies that you would like to discuss?
Oh, geez. I'm trying to think. I'm guessing that I might think of some after we end the show. I'll think of a few, but I'm guessing that probably our listeners, if they've hung on this long, are likely to come up with more as well, because I know that we got a lot of good ones at the Stutter Talk Facebook page as well. So
yeah, and I say with a smile on my face, don't send us an email that says I came up with the stuttering onion, because you did, because somebody else did.
Right.
Trust me. But having said that, send your comments, thoughts, and analogies to stuttertalk@stuttertalk.com. Dr. Robert Quisel at Western Illinois University, thank you so much for joining us for this marathon edition of Stutter Talk.
Okay, Peter. Thanks.
Trying my patience, try pink carnations, red roses, and yellow daffodils. Don't forget the flowers someday. I know you.